As part of this year's stewardship campaign, I'd like to welcome Bobby Myers to the pulpit to tell us what this year's theme, Growing Our Generosity, means to her.
Hi. Unlike last time I stood up here, I am not going to dance for you today. You're welcome. But I did bring with me one of the most generous gifts I've ever received in my life. It's not bedazzled in diamonds, and it doesn't hold any secrets to the universe. And what's inside costs about $20. In March of 2010, my husband and I lived in Akron, Ohio, where we'd moved for his job. We had no family there, no friends yet. He worked a lot. I worked from home. And the sun didn't come out there in Akron, Ohio, like, ever. And my world felt a little lonely. So on the day of my 30th birthday, I walked into my home office and I found it filled with helium balloons, and from each one dangled a letter. Weeks and weeks prior, my husband had helped himself to my email address book and sent out a call to everyone in it saying, "Bobby needs to feel surrounded by love right now on her birthday. Could you write her a letter?" And they did. I know. Thanks, honey. And they did. Family members and longtime friends and old bosses and old college roommates and old professors, old boyfriends, everybody. And they wrote to me telling me why they valued our friendship and why they valued me. And across the miles and the time zones, it felt like they were reminding me that we belonged to each other. It cost them a postage stamp and some time. And it was an incredible act of generosity. Generosity means offering what you can with a free and willing heart. And here in this community, I see all of the forms that it can take. It looks like the clear, shoveled walkway to our front door the morning after a snow. It looks like the willing hands that chop wood and carry water, plan the service, practice the music, prepare the bulletins, greet the people, teach the children, serve coffee, wash the dishes. Generosity sounds like your voices singing my children, my child, our children, out to their classes. A moment in which my most treasured thing, my son, is held and seen in a loving community. It costs just this little bit of time, and it is priceless. Generosity looks like our members and friends who help lead service and share their thoughts and their ideas and their talents. It looks like those who say yes with their time and serve on committees. It looks like anyone who carries our fellowship's beliefs and visions out into the world. Generosity feels like an embrace when someone is in struggle, and it sounds like a voicemail from a friend saying, "I see you." It is felt during service when we share joys and concerns, because listening is an act of complete generosity and love that costs only time but is priceless. Generosity is service to community both when it is joyous and when it takes some effort. The generosity I know here inspires me to ask, are my values aligned with how I spend my time? And what do I have to give? For each of us, the answer is different. It's a dollar amount and a signature on a check. It's a gift of yourself and your time. Maybe it's a little bit of both. In 2 Corinthians, Paul the Apostle wrote, "Remember this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows generously will reap generously. Each of you should give what you have decided in your heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion." Teddy Roosevelt said it simpler by just saying, do what you can with what you have where you're at. Here we all are. I see you. I see the work you do. I am made better by it. And the world is less lonely because of it. Because real generosity is simply remembering that we belong to each other. Thank you.
I'm sure you're wondering what that piece of paper on your chair was this morning, and Shannon Beavers is going to come tell us very briefly about it.
Good morning, everyone. When you came in this morning, there was a paper on your chair. That was your 2020 interest and gift survey. This is probably looks very redundant to you, and you might be asking yourself, why are we doing these silly things? Well, the reason is the membership team needs to get the most current and up-to-date information available from you. Many times in our lives, we change our internet carrier or our internet providers and our phone carriers, and we forget to change those numbers or those email addresses. This gives us a way to do that. Now, you might be asking yourself, is there any way we can get away from doing these silly things over and over again? And I have that answer. Yes. The IT committee, in their infinite wisdom, have been researching a new database for the UUFD, and they have found one called Breeze. I have been fortunate enough to get to fiddle with Breeze a little bit, and I want to tell you it's a breeze to use as well. Soon, each of you will be able to do all of this yourself on your own personal profile. With that being said, I'd like to draw your attention to the front page of your survey, if you can please look at it. The very last question asks you if you would like some assistance setting up your Breeze account. It's our hope to have some folks stationed over at Fellowship Time once this software is integrated to help you do just that. If maybe you need some help with your mobile app, you think, or setting up your account, please circle yes. If you can flip over to the back page. At the top of the page is the important information that I need, your name, your address, blah, blah, blah. We are also in the process of making new name tags, and one of the things we're going to add to the name tags is your personal pronoun. As an LGBTQ welcoming congregation, I think this is an excellent thing to have on our name tags, and you can still keep your ribbon if you want it. If you'll please circle that, I would appreciate it. And then two-thirds of the way down the sheet, you'll see this yellow star. This is just for your protection. This is where you can sign up to be in a leadership position. And I just want to avoid the stampede of volunteers who would like to be in that leadership position. So this is a discreet way to sign up. If you'll just take a look at all the different categories and interests, and maybe you want to see yourself doing some of these things in the future, just circle that for me, please. When you're finished, if you will leave them on your seat like you found them, or there'll be several membership team members in the back that would be happy to take them from you. Thank you all very much.
It is great to be back here. Thank you for having me back. I am finally nearing the end of my seminary experience. I was a part-time 5-year student. I graduate in May. And I am so grateful for the opportunities that I have been given to experience wonderful congregations like this one. I love what you've done with your platform, by the way, too. It's incredible. My teaching pastor calls it a grace slap when we get something we did nothing to deserve. So I thank you for this grace slap. When I was here before, I think I mentioned that I believe my calling is not pastoral ministry or not congregational ministry, but community ministry. Well, I've started in community ministry in Albuquerque. I am working for a health services corporation, and my work is providing support for those struggling with addiction. My primary work is with people who are currently incarcerated. I work with preparing them for re-entry into our communities. I do this by introducing them to recovery resources and providing pastoral care as they work to repair their lives and the relationships. Some are young, very young. So for them, it is not about repairing, it's about developing healthy life skills for the first time. I find that this work is about resilience after trauma. So my job is primarily in the field of human resilience. A big part of human life involves resilience and healing. Responding effectively when things don't go along nicely, do not go along in an ideal way, or do not go along as we wish. Resilience is about bouncing back. It's about finding oneself in an undesired condition or situation and finding a way through that situation. Many of the people I work with have experienced multiple trauma situations, and addiction itself is a trauma situation. It requires resilience and healing. Now, in doing this, the common question I get is, if this is your calling, why didn't you go into social work or psychology? I too struggled with that question. And in fact, just after my retirement, I started down that very path. However, I found that what I really am called to is to focus on the spiritual aspects of healing and resilience, and the value I have found in using religion and philosophy in promoting healing and resilience. Specifically, in the usefulness of Unitarian Universalism in healing and resilience. I don't think we give that enough credit or enough attention. The usefulness of Unitarian Universalism in healing and resilience. Now, on a side observation, I will admit that the formal education associated with training in those other areas sounds better. Those areas are associated with a Master of Science degree. For ministry, it's a Master of Divinity. Really? Does that sound like a serious thing? Doesn't Master of Divinity sound like an imaginary character or a superhero or maybe someone in a late night television ad asking for donations in exchange for promises of salvation? It seems clear that resilience after trauma requires a holistic approach, because trauma has a holistic effect. By holistic, I mean affecting all aspects of human functioning. It affects us physically, mentally, socially, and spiritually. As a result of trauma, we develop physical ailments. We struggle with mental health and intellectual functioning, with emotional functioning, and with social functioning. Trauma also causes us to struggle spiritually with finding meaning and purpose in our lives. So, what is trauma? We all struggle. Many of us here today are facing struggles in our lives. Many of us have experienced things that we would identify as traumatic. We all experience trauma to various degrees. We experience situations that cause us to doubt ourselves, to feel fearful, uncertain, and inadequate. This is part of being human, of being put into this world having been issued a human life. So what does all this have to do with Unitarian Universalism? During what I call my church shopping days, I had gone through a stage of discomfort with the religion of my childhood. Then, having attempted to discard all religion, I began to search for what I once thought existed. I searched various religions and philosophies, looking for that one guide that would prove most valuable in managing my life effectively. I believe then, and I still do, in a utilitarian approach. The engineers in the audience will, or in the congregation will understand that. I believe in this utilitarian approach to most things, and when I look at a religion or philosophy, I am looking for whether it is useful to me. I believe that religion in general is useful in that it attempts to answer those big questions, those big overarching questions that we struggle with in life. Needless to say, I did not find that one guide, but in the process, I became fascinated with the many different religions and philosophies. Unfortunately, I found that many of them, although they may address different aspects of that holistic pie, they tend to have one area of the pie that is favored more than the others. Most seem to favor the physical or the spiritual and do not seem to consider equally the two or the other pieces of the holistic pie. So what's different about Unitarian Universalism? When we take Unitarian Universalism as it exists now, in its entirety and depth, it promotes a holistic approach to life management. This, however, may not be the way we use it or the way we apply it. The way we apply Unitarian Universalism is often that we pick and choose and we lean toward one part or the other. We seem to feel like we need to make choices and stick to just one part. We do this rather than looking at it more deeply and completely and seeing it as an invitation to a holistic approach, an approach which encourages incorporation of the physical, intellectual, and spiritual. And yes, even the supernatural part. Unitarian Universalism points us to an honest and open search for truth, and it suggests places or sources for us to look for this truth. And this leads us to a holistic approach to life management. We are mind, body, and spirit, and the sources of wisdom suggested by this faith, by Unitarian Universalism, address the mind, body, and spirit. They encourage us to develop tools in multiple areas such that we are prepared to be resilient in multiple ways. Science looks at the physical world and tells us to stay fit and eat healthy and make use of scientifically developed tools and discoveries and medications and techniques. Nature calls us to be aware of natural rhythms, the rhythms of our planet, the rhythms of our lives. And to listen to our inner selves. The scriptures of world religions call us to attribute meaning and purpose beyond the physical, the measurable, and the tangible. We have all had experiences in non-holistic religions and philosophies. I was raised in a religion which attributed meaning primarily to the supernatural. When I became uncomfortable with this, I turned to a reliance on science, which attributed no meaning to anything beyond the physical, tangible, and measurable. I struggled. I then turned to a philosophy that discards the supernatural entirely and places humans above nature rather than humans as part of nature. Unitarian Universalism allows for greater resilience by way of encouraging us to use multiple tools. Depending on the situation, we can use a scientific approach when it seems appropriate, but we can also use a spiritual approach for those times that science has not yet been able to bring the situation into the measurable, the quantifiable, the explainable, those situations where human understanding is insufficient. Unitarian Universalism encourages us to look in places geared toward the rational or intellectual, but it also suggests places to look that are clearly focused on the physical, and it encourages us to look in places that are typically considered to be associated with feeding the spirit or the soul, those immeasurable things, those supernatural things. So do you heed the guidance in Unitarian Universalism to look to many sources of the world's wisdom to support your holistic healing, to support resilience? Holistic health promotes the overall health and well-being of individuals, families, and communities. How is your holistic health? How are the components of your holistic health? How is your emotional well-being? What do you do to create or enhance your quality of life? What do you do in a day that is important to you and that makes you feel better about the day or better about yourself? How do you manage stress and cope with difficult emotions? How do you take care of yourself? What gives you pleasure? Do you notice and pay attention to when you are feeling good? Or do you only pay attention and notice when you are feeling bad? How is your psychological well-being? What gives your life meaning, purpose, or a sense of direction? Do you feel comfortable in expressing your own ideas and opinions? What parts of yourself do you most like? What parts of yourself do you most value? What experiences have challenged you to grow and to become a better person? How is your social well-being? Do you believe that people, society, and you can change? What are your beliefs about people in general? What do you do to contribute to society? How is your spiritual well-being? Do you ask yourself what your essential beliefs are for meaning in life? What are the safe places and people in your life? People or places that can strengthen your life meaning? And do you have rituals and practices? Rituals and practices that keep you in touch with yourself and in touch with your sense of core meaning and value. These are questions I ask, and Unitarian Universalism suggests 6 sources to address these questions in such a way that I can have life and have it more abundantly. The world's wisdom traditions have developed many ways to mend the separation and fragmentation that occurs in every human life when we face the reality of trauma and struggle. Unitarian Universalism supports using all of these various wisdom traditions toward a holistic approach to healing and to resilience. May we each find the full extent of our powers of healing and resilience by heeding guidance to a holistic approach to managing our lives. May it be so.
Understanding of community development concepts, how to work on social justice, and as well as individual work, which go together because they're part that they're together in your seminary experience. And if not, have you had other training or other experiences that help you to guide you toward this community aspect that you speak about? Because I've been a community social worker, or was until I retired. So that was my question.
Okay. No. in my seminary, there's very little training in social work and administrative stuff. It's improving. I will give it that. It's improving. But the seminary program that I'm going through is designed to produce congregational ministers to be senior pastors in congregations. Currently at Meadville Lombard, I can't say currently, when I was looking at the program, there was no equal path to community ministry. You have to go through congregational. So I was asking, if I already know that I don't want congregational, is this useful to me? And my question wasn't really answered. There's a path, and it's difficult to graduate without that internship in congregational. I would love to see an internship in community ministry. I've met only a couple of students who managed to work with the seminary to have their internship in community ministry satisfy the Master of Divinity degree requirements. Mm-hmm. So the seminary is not there yet. My seminary is not there yet. But there's an awareness of it. There's more talk about it. The UUA fellowshipping document has a little, and oh, by the way, if you're going into community ministry, da-da-da-da-da, answer these questions. So that's new. That's a new revision of that fellowshipping manual that we have to satisfy all these. I have to check a bunch of boxes to get in front of the fellowshipping committee. So what I have learned in the area of social justice and social work was when I started, I didn't know what I wanted to do next, and I went back and started pursuing an associate's degree in human services. And that's where I got to explore the social work path and the psychology path, and that's where I came to the conclusion that what is missing, in my opinion, is the ministry path, the path of spiritual, using spirituality in all of its definitions to support healing and resilience. It seems like we have, when we talk about spirituality, you have got to do some things like be born again and give your life over to, and all those phrases that sound to me very, very claustrophobic. So that's what I saw was missing, and I decided that there was a need in our faith to go to do community work. Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious what that looks like. In other words, are you employed by someone? What do community ministers do? I'll show my ignorance.
Right now, you have to have another means of income or you're probably not going to do it. I have a couple of classmates who are affiliated with the congregation, meaning that they have like the umbrella of the congregation, but they work in the community as a nonprofit and do the work. They do a lot of fundraising. They do a lot of grant writing in order to support themselves, and they are affiliated with a congregation, which allows them to continue through primary fellowshipping and into final fellowshipping and all that other stuff that gets you recognized as a full-fledged minister in the eyes of the UUA. And then some of them start down the path, and then they go into like interim ministry. So they're sometimes congregational, they're sometimes community. A couple of people I've met, not in Unitarian Universalism, I believe they were Unitarians Considering Christ, UCC, were executive directors of nonprofits. So there are other things. Some corporations have chaplains now, yeah. And that's considered, chaplaincy is kind of considered, depending on the setting, it may be considered community ministry. There is now a community ministers association in the UUA. So GA last year, I was able to make some connections like that. And there's a innovative ministry group that just started up, which is very, very interesting. People finding innovative ways to use Unitarian Universalism in our communities and with individuals, with families, with communities, and so on. So
we aren't great like community proselytizers, but yeah, it would be. There seems like there would be a way to do outreach if we can find a funding source.
There are people who I've run into who are throwing around the phrase evangelical UU, They're trying to make the point that we are so non-proselytizing that we don't even tell anybody we exist. So they use some of the same terminology, like, you know, what's your elevator speech and how do you tell people about the good news?
Who do we accept as our personal savior in that case?
Yeah.
I'm sort of lost there. Other comments? Oh, there you go.
So I really appreciated the pauses because I was writing notes. but I wanted to ask, you talked a lot about, you know, finding balance and you know, that it's not just the physical and it's not just the spiritual, but it's finding that place where we're utilizing both. And I find for myself, I lean one direction, and I find that I would say the majority of people tend to lean the other direction. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wanting to hear from you about what are some of the tools that you use in order to find that balance again and in order to recenter yourself?
It's really about just being open to ideas. One of the first things that really struck me is that I had to go into training to do the work now to get a certified thing to work with people in recovery. And in New Mexico, I'd done that work in Wisconsin. In New Mexico, the training looks a little different, but the people doing the work look very different. Many of them are Native, and they include some, I would call, naturalistic kind of stuff that I'd never heard of. So I went to a training, and instead of going away with a list of support groups, I actually went away with sage and sweetgrass. Some of the things they do, they detox differently. They use sweat lodges to detox, but it's being open to different things and being able to have conversations with people who do things differently. Yep. And that was not true in my past life. If you can't measure it, quantify it, and draw a graph that proves it, then it must not be right. So.
Yep.
Hi, I'm Carolyn. Just thanks so much for your service this morning and also your service in the community in Albuquerque, right? Correct? Yeah, I'm the granddaughter of alcoholics, and I've been in Al-Anon for 7 years, and I'm just know so deeply how that the community that's affected by addiction needs healing in a spiritual sense, as well as the balance and all that. So I'm just really grateful that you're doing that work. Thank you.
I was curious as to how you approach someone that you don't know who's incarcerated then. Where do you start to find out, are they open to what you would like to share with them, and how does that dialogue begin?
The conversation starts out always person-centered. What do they see as where they want to be? Where do they want to go? What do they see as the problem they're having? And then some of the questions similar to what I brought out in the sermon are the questions to ask. And if that conversation is done slowly enough, they will usually tell me that they're already headed down that path, and that is fantastic. If they've already got something that feeds their soul, then my next question is, well, are you doing it? Are you using it if you know this works? And if they don't have something like that, then that's when I start talking about other possibilities and the usefulness of doing something spiritual. So it kind of depends on where they are.
Mm-hmm. Are you allowed to bring in books and reading material or?
Not much while they are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. But after that, yes, I've lost a lot of books. I loan books, and either it gets left on the table and they say, that's nice, take that home with you, or I never get it back, which I'm hoping that means they valued it and they kept it.
Yep.
Okay. We have a 25-year-old granddaughter who's a on and off heroin addict, I guess. She's been through rehab probably 5 or 6 times. And we see her occasionally. I'm wondering if you have any words of wisdom for us as the grandparents who don't have a lot of, regular connection with her, but periodically she'll call up and periodically she'll actually come visit. And she's on and off.
The thing that I've seen work best is getting people engaged with peers. Addictionologist is now a thing in psychology more so than medical. I wish it were more in medical. Most medical doctors don't deal well with substance use disorders. But incredible things happen when people get an opportunity to talk with peers. Other people who are living in recovery, who have gone through addictive behavior and substance use disorders and made it through. And that is, other than a support group, that's difficult to find, because most of us who have gone through it, I'm pretty sure I mentioned before, I'm 8 years in recovery from alcohol use disorder. And most of us, once we get our lives back together and get everything fixed. I say that because that's really not the way it works. The mechanism, you don't get fixed. You there's resilience and you learn coping skills and so on. But we don't talk about it anymore. And our society attributes such stigma that we are discouraged from talking about it. So we don't get to help those other people. That's another reason why I do this kind of work, is to help people to understand that you're not weak, you're not a bad person. This is not, you don't label the person. We don't use addict. We use someone who is struggling with substance use disorder. It's a lot of words, but it's much gentler. It is person-centered. It's recovery-centered. All of those things, and I believe they matter a lot. They matter to me. Because in our society, we tend to take that or try to enforce that. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Just stop doing that. My family was, why don't you just stop buying it? Well, thank you for that. I'm going to write that down. So that getting peer support and affirming that the person is not the addiction, that there's a good person there, and no one starts using a substance with the intent to fail horribly and end up in the situation where it takes us. So those are the two things, just, my first thoughts of.
I was wondering, is there some majority of cases of certain elements, certain addictions, in New Mexico? Is it mainly alcohol, or is it drugs, or is there some overriding one, or is it pretty well distributed?
The health department has some good stuff. If you look at substance use disorder epidemiology or something like that, it's a big report that gives you all the numbers of what it looks like. My experience since I've been here is that the primary are meth and heroin, but then we're in the midst of an opioid crisis. But that the opioid crisis is very interesting in how it's defined. It became a national health problem, but only when the people struggling were the middle class people who started off with painkillers, became addicted, and then the medical community got some pushback for maybe over-prescribing, And they pulled back on the prescriptions after these people are addicted. And the people who are addicted don't fit the stereotype. They're not sleeping under a bridge. The people who fit the stereotype are flying our planes, are our judges, are our police officers, are our nurses and doctors. And then it became a national health crisis because of the population. Many of those people, after they were addicted and the prescriptions were taken away, went to heroin. And that's the story behind the opioid crisis. But my personal experience, when I go to someone, I'm working out of Valencia County Detention Center is my primary location to meet incarcerated members of this program. The meth is what I hear the most. And then heroin's next in line. So. Yeah.
Just a real quick question. Are you saying that those are ahead of alcohol?
Say it again.
That meth and opioids are ahead of alcohol as far as addiction? Or
people don't usually come up and state that their first is alcohol because we don't have respect for the evil of alcohol. I use that word evil. We don't consider it a drug. It is. We don't take it seriously. It's in the drugstores. It's in the gas stations. And most of those people, if I sit and talk to them for a while, they will also say they have a problem with alcohol. Many of them will say it started with alcohol, that they got drunk and tried meth, that they got drunk and tried heroin. But we don't have a handle on how big and how just overwhelming the alcohol problem is in New Mexico, where I'm working. Is just, it's incredible, the alcohol problem.
Are you familiar with the Portuguese approach to recreational drug use?
I don't think so.
Okay. Briefly. About 18 years ago, a dictator was thrown out of Portugal, and they elected a legislature, and one of the things they did says the war on drugs is over and we have lost. And they decriminalized every single drug that one could think of. And with the money saved from putting people in jail, they set up free rehab clinics. Okay, so now we got 15 years worth of experience with it. And on a national level, it seems to be quite effective. The most prevalent crime in Portugal, from what I read, is pickpockets. Okay, so anyway, I didn't mean to give a sermon. I just wondered whether you'd heard of it.
I haven't heard of that one, but I'm definitely a fan of decriminalizing substance use disorders. It's not working. Many of the people in our jails and prisons, their major crime is they have a substance use disorder. Yep. And that the punishment technique doesn't work. Locking people up doesn't work. Treatment works different depending on the type of treatment. The most positive effects that have been documented are really amazing things like community, connectedness, responsibility, meaning in life. People want to be connected in some way, and they want to have purpose. They want to be needed. All those fluffy things that I can't believe that we don't do those, and they work. I spent 14 months living in an Oxford house in Wisconsin. It's a self-governing, self-supporting, sober living house. And self-governing meaning that there is no staff. The residents run the house. So all it is a bunch of people living together, keeping each other clean and sober. And it works. It's got an incredible success rate. And that's what works, but we don't do that. We just, I, I, I don't know. It's starting a little bit in my hometown. The district attorney, of all people, is in favor of decriminalizing. He started with marijuana, decriminalizing marijuana. So some people get it, but there seems to be an overwhelming section of our society that wants to punish.
Yeah.
And even though the numbers show that doesn't work.
I'm real fascinated by your comment earlier about sort of relaxing the labels and saying someone who's struggling with this problem. And I think it also applies in the mental health arena. And there's often big overlap between addiction and mental health issues.
Yes, absolutely.
And my husband struggles with some of that as well and is 30 years recovered from alcoholism, but it was probably his mental struggles that pushed him into that.
Yes.
And I'm also fascinated with how labels are so restricting because there's so much of a fingerprint to who this person is that is unique. And it's a blend of something. And it's a blend of whatever traumas occurred or whatever. Do you have any ideas on how to help culture recognize the complexities and the value of destigmatization?
My first thought is that it starts small. I've been working with my teaching congregation, first with the staff, to change their language. But it has to be deeper than that. I think we're living in a situation, unfortunately, where we can't just tell people that this is the wrong terminology. We have to do deeper. We got into this thing where things are politically correct, and all it took was one outspoken person high enough up to do away with all the language stuff, and everybody else admitted that it's uncomfortable for them to be politically correct and worry about politically correct, and it's because the deeper work wasn't done to get them to understand the effect of it. So that is an excellent question, and my first thought is that it has to start with the small groups, and it has to start with when I'm standing in line at the grocery store and someone uses a term, and I say, is that, you know, do you just call that person a junkie? Is that all that person is? Do you know anything else about that person? And, you know, sometimes it's, well, it was my cousin, but, you know, so I don't think we understand that the, you know, the biblical stuff maybe. First there was the word. I mean, the words are incredibly powerful, and we don't realize that. Basic human services training is you can get such a more positive reaction from someone if you, based on what you call them, what you say to them, how you speak to them.
So I just kind of wanted to check with you because you had mentioned taking UUA into the streets and getting it out to more people, and I just wanted to hear from you about what are the reference points that you start with, and how do you, like, where is it that you begin that conversation, and how do you then let people know, like, this is how it could help you?
I first started doing that. I did my CPE, clinical pastoral education, that we're required to do as part of seminary, as part of fellowshipping. And I worked in a halfway house that housed people who have a substance use disorder and are HIV positive. So, in other words, their relapse is a death sentence, because they're on so many meds to deal with the HIV positive part. If they do anything unhealthy that challenges their immune system, that's you know, they don't have a positive outcome. And what I started doing was asking a kind of the holistic question of what's your support system? What are the things that help you? And then I would, spiritual, the word spiritual could kind of work, Many of them have been in bad experiences with religion, with conservative religions that have discarded them because of some behavior they had. So I couldn't say religion. So I had to stick with spiritual search. And what does spiritual mean to you? Just, you know, very basic questions to get them thinking about is there some other tool I could be using to help with the difficult times, to help with the struggles, to give me something to believe in, some meaning, so that it's a difficult conversation, and I've found that it has to be started very gently or they're lost immediately because they think you want them to be born again or to do something with their soul.
Yeah,
or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, thank you. We started with Path to Ministry and we came back to a lot of resilience talk, which was which is good. Thank you. Graham had, the owner of the coat has been found. Okay.